This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
As she rides, she casts hard, sharp, tiny shards of ice around her, and woe betide anyone whose eye or heart is pierced by one of them. That person is then lost. No longer will anything gladden them. They will find anything that doesn't have the whiteness of snow ugly, obnoxious, repugnant. They will not find peace, will abandon everything, and will set off after the queen in pursuit of their dream and love. Naturally, they will never find it, and will die of longing.
Hello and welcome, everyone. A Shard of Ice we will be covering today from A Sword of Destiny. Super excited to be here. Before we get into all the good stuff, I present to you Kylifer. I live in the cold north in Canada here, so I am a queen of ice, I guess, because I'm complaining about it. We got Azizugal and Aedgin Mikal. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
You're not.
As you guys. Hello. Wait, shame myself? Oh, nice. Getting a nice shame bell. And for those of you who have been here before, we have two types of versions of this podcast. We do the live version here on YouTube, which is our 10th version of a live stream here on YouTube. And then we have our podcast version on Anchor, which we have a couple of more episodes because we did a bonus spoiler episode. And we split that up and Aziz is an editing wizard. So two versions, one here on YouTube, one on Anchor.
Geralt the Witcher stares down the waste and refuse of an entire city. Though he has little trouble defeating the Zugul that lurks within, a creature that had killed 8 people, he spends the rest of the story trying not to be as miserable as the trash dump. Or, arguably, he tries very hard to be as miserable as this huge mass of refuse, depending on your perspective. Either way, it's unclear if he succeeds, which is in itself a bad sign. You've heard the phrase, down in the dumps? Well, rarely has it been so apt. He returns to his place of residence to clean up, and we see that he's living with Yennefer, whose magic comes in very handy at bath time. Geralt had previously expressed that the spread of civilization was ending the need for witchers, but Yennefer disagrees.
You see, even in the city, it's easy for a witcher to find work. You don't have to roam the wilds. Istrith maintains that after the extinction of a forest or marsh creature, another one always replaces it. A new mutation adapted to the artificial environment created by humans.
Clearly, this Istrith fellow disagrees as well. And Geralt, though he doesn't say it out loud, seems to think they're right after all. This isn't the only thought he keeps to himself, each time wary of a confrontation. Keeping frustrations to yourself, swallowing them, holding them down, and inability to communicate, these are not good signs for a relationship. So too is Geralt's jealousy over Istrith, and vice versa, it turns out, because Yennefer has relationships with them both. Such arrangements can be made to work, but we quickly learn that's not in the cards for this particular case. They are 3 humans that have lived lifespans of lengths that are rather inhuman, and for the same reason they have limited options for long-term romantic partners. That's an argument for coexistence, but again, their long lifespans have somewhat limited their capacity for change. Not to mention powerful people are used to others adjusting to them, not for them. This cocktail of expectations, ego, and power is a centerpiece of the story as the 3 focal points, Geralt, Yennefer, and Istrith, struggle with their own selves as much, if not more so, than they struggle with each other. The setting is Aedhgin Vale, which translates to Shard of Ice, an elven place, though not a city, as elves don't build such. It stood long before humans existed on the continent at all, let alone before the human civilization that occupies it now. Yennefer says of the place,
"There is the legend of the Queen of Winter traveling across the country through a blizzard on a sleigh drawn by white horses. She sows hard, sharp, tiny shards of ice as she goes, and woe betide he should one of those shards pierce his eye or heart. That someone is lost forever."
This would make for a very good description of Geralt himself, who spends most, if not all, of this story miserable, hateful, depressed, and finally resigned. But that's the way of things when you have a passion for a partner in a relationship in the midst of it falling apart. Geralt perhaps doesn't notice the symbolism as we readers do, but he knows about that legend, or rather...
It's not a legend, Yen. It's a beautiful way to describe the terrible phenomenon called the Wild Hunt, a curse apparent in certain lands. An irrational collective insanity drives people to follow the ghostly procession racing across the sky. I've seen it. Indeed, it's not uncommon in winter.
Geralt may be right about the historical facts, but he and Istrith behave as if they have those very shards of ice in their hearts, following Yennefer to the point that death from sorrow seems entirely possible. She makes it quite clear that if she didn't want to spend time with one or both of them, she would not hesitate to end things. Despite the clear truth of that, I mean, she is, after all, very assertive, this is not enough for either of them, who seem to grudgingly accept that she wants to have flings, but sharing her with someone she genuinely has deep feelings for, they just aren't happy about that, to put it mildly. Yennefer, extraordinarily powerful, has created a black kestrel, saying she needs it, but she won't say what for. The bird is capable of speech, making it capable of delivering messages by speech or by carrier method. But she laments that despite the ability to create life and many other wonders, there is so much she can't control. For example, these two men. She has enormous power over them, but she can't control, say, how they feel. Furthermore, the Witcher and the Sorcerer seek each other out to confront the situation. At first, the two men argue, quite effectively showing their skills at insulting each other. Their blows are well-aimed, intending to prove that the other is not actually an equal after all. Istrith repeats the frequently held belief that Witchers are emotionless, as evidence that Yennefer will lose interest, while Geralt points out his opportunity to have her to himself, if it ever existed, lies in the past. Digging into the past doesn't deter Istrith, who, apart from being a sorcerer, is an archaeologist. The banter proceeds, but neither seems to have a significant edge, so they call it a day. But in another way, Geralt is at a disadvantage. The same one facing him way back in Blaviken. The local authorities, meaning the ones in power, value Istrith, their local magician. He's prestigious, well-known, and an employer. So they have use for a witcher, but as we saw, it involves tasks like standing thigh-deep in wet garbage, facing prejudice and suspicion at the bathhouse when getting cleaned up, and then getting cheated of payment. It's not the same for Istrith. Worse, when he does try to cheat him for the fee for the Zugul, the man's top lieutenant turns out to be a murderer named the Cicada, who repeatedly tries to provoke Geralt. Numerous aspects of the city, in other words, work for Istrith while working against Geralt, and numerous things try to provoke Geralt while working for Istrith. Geralt is keenly aware of all this. He knows Istrith is powerful enough to kill him with ease, he's getting constant reminders of how much of an outsider he is, and he knows he can't steer Yennefer to a different course. And as if he has that proverbial shard of ice in heart, leaving her isn't an option either. His inability to control any of what's happening, even his feelings about the situation, only make it all worse. Ironic, given that according to popular myth, he's not supposed to have feelings at all. Yennefer tries to stop him from despairing and spiraling, but he's quite stuck. Though he loves her, he knows she's pondering an offer of monogamy from Istrith, and that terrifies him. From Yennefer's perspective, however, it seems Istrith's offer to commit was made somewhat in desperation, as much a means to get rid of Geralt or challenge him as anything to do with just Istrith and Yennefer's relationship. She proceeds to make a second black kestrel in front of Geralt, lamenting that she was wrong to think only one would suffice. This is ominous, though Geralt doesn't perceive why. He's more blown away by creating life out of nothing. Yennefer is coming to realize that neither of her lovers are handling this well at all. This is simply not going to work, and if she doesn't take action, something terrible might happen. Indeed, the next day, the two men agree that they must fight to the death. It shows the depth of their passion in a somewhat twisted way, but they actually begin to understand each other.
In our arrogance, continued the magician, we thought that Yenna wouldn't hesitate to choose the better of us. As for who was the better, neither of us had any doubt. We came to the point where, like a pair of urchins, we bragged about the regard she has shown us, and like inexperienced boys, we even divulged the nature of that regard and what it meant. I imagine that, like myself, you've been thinking about it and have realized just how wrong we were.
Geralt completely agrees. They hate each other, but the disrespect between them is fading. It's difficult to hold on to the hypocrisy of despising what your beloved loves. A decent person can't live with that contradiction. But the more they respect each other, the deeper the rivalry is, the bigger the threat. They know, but they can't help themselves.
Geralt?
What?
Don't you feel stupid?
I feel stupid.
The Witcher admitted reluctantly.
The duel is set for the next morning, but Geralt's conscience begins to eat at him. He's not afraid to face Dithrith, but he doesn't want to. A part of him would rather die first, and that part of him almost wins out as he heads to a bad part of town to drink, leaving his weapons behind and flashing his money. He wants to be attacked. He gets what he's after. He's assaulted, but the back alley thugs, despite landing several blows, take note of his unnaturally swift reflexes and then his Witcher medallion. Two of them run off in terror, while the third gives up more calmly, adding an oddly insightful parting shot.
Next time, when you want to kill yourself, Witcher, don't try to get others to do it for you. Just hang yourself by your reins in the stables.
The next morning, he dresses for the duel and decides it's a beautiful morning. Is it resignation? Relief that it will be one way or another over with? Well, he sighs and spits, only to find the cicada standing there. The one man in the store who actually truly wants to fight, and he's dressed for it. But Geralt mercifully shows him how out of place he is, only ruining his face instead of ending his life. He doesn't actually respect the cicada enough to kill him. Istrith, however...
On his belt hung a sword, a beautiful light sword with a swept hilt, the tip of the scabbard brushing against the cuff of his shiny riding boot. On the magician's shoulder sat a black bird, a kestrel.
Istrith laughs long and loud and says that Yennefer wanted to save them both, but here they are about to duel anyway. He admits that Yennefer has rejected his proposal of monogamy and ended their relationship in the process. He wants to duel anyway, though. He cannot face life without her and is ready to cross swords with a Witcher without using his magic. This is basically suicide, and they both know it. But Geralt is not pleased by this. Istrith may think that he's lost, but Geralt hasn't won. He knows the great loss the sorcerer is feeling because he's feeling it too. From the moment Geralt saw that kestrel, he understood. Istrith insists they fight, but Geralt refuses to even draw his sword. The Witcher is aware of something that Istrith is not, that there's a second kestrel. Geralt knows that she sent him one bearing a similar message. They've both lost her. She's likely already left town. Istrith continues to demand the duel proceed, but there's no reason to fight anymore. The only thing to do is walk away.
Istrid, he said over his shoulder, don't drag anyone else into this. If you want to do it, just hang yourself by the reins in the stables.
Geralt, shouted the magician, his voice cracked suddenly with a note of hopelessness that grated on the ears. I won't give up. I'll follow her to Vengerberg. I'll go to the ends of the earth to find her. I won't ever give up on her. Know this.
The Witcher knows this is true, and he knows why it's truth. Truth is a shard of ice.
There can only be one Highlander, is how I felt.
Yeah,
there can only be one. Anyway, so yeah, we talked about this privately. Was it yesterday or Tuesday? A couple days ago, Tuesday, and I went back and listened to the audiobook. We all talked about how we were doing rereads for this one. And this one is kind of, let's talk about like the fan reaction, I guess, and then our reactions, because this one is kind of seen as one of the least favorites, I guess, of Sword of Destiny on Reddit and just kind of out there. But, you know, we talked about it and just the story of the Ice Queen and kind of the delving in of the relationships of Yennefer and Istrith and Yennefer and Geralt, but also just like Sapkowski revealing why Geralt and Yennefer are the way they are. I felt like that was really powerful, and it's a big step, because the next four stories, I wouldn't say Eternal Flame, but the three stories after that really kind of start to get into the main plot. And then we start to, the final two stories of Sword of Destiny get right into the main plot. So this is kind of an important setting up of like, hey, you know, this is how Yennefer feels. This is how Geralt feels. And that's kind of my reaction to it. At first, it wasn't my favorite, but like after my second and third read, I like it a lot more, because there's a lot of analogies I find in this short story, you know, with the Zugul and the trash, you know what I mean? Like human nature, like, you know, just like being in the dumps. Obviously the shard of ice in your heart, you know, vampires can only be killed with stakes, but imagine being killed by love and the lack of love. Those are some pretty interesting things. So I actually really enjoyed this a lot more than I thought. And I think this is one of the better short stories in Sword of Destiny. But we say that about every short story after we read it, because we like all of them. But yeah, like my initial feelings on it were kind of this, like the same as the fandom. And now that I've read it more and talk with you guys more about it, like, you know, nerded out about it, I liked it a lot more, I think.
Yeah, I think, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think people who don't like the story are wrong. I get it. It's not an action-packed story. A lot of perceived action winds up being completely unimportant. It really is all about feelings and relationships. And I mean, it's a breakup story. That's what it is. And that's not always fun to read, but I think it's really well orchestrated. And like, you know, again, obviously Sapkowski like does a lot of that stuff where he'll have the character say things and you have to like hunt through the story to figure out what they mean and like where this is coming from and whatever. And I get it. It's not like an easy read, but I think that it really provides a lot of powerful emotions. And when viewed in the wider context of Sword of Destiny, it's a really important part of Geralt and Yennefer's journey. Specifically, more Geralt than Yennefer, but like a really important, you know, if they get together in the first story, then they break up now. And then we'll talk later, you know, in future episodes about how Geralt's arc and how their relationship plays out from there. Yeah, I think it's really essential. And I think there's a lot of pain in the story that is really kind of just out there unashamedly presented. And it's not like, it's not an embarrassing thing to feel pain over the end of a relationship. And I think that's really cool.
And when you say you're wrong, I find it interesting because a lot of the negative fan reaction is based on Yennefer's shadiness.
Yeah.
Like that kind of framing of the situation. And we talked about that, like Yennefer's kind of perception of things and the way she feels about herself. Like she's had a really difficult life. I mean, she was a hunchback. The way she views herself and loves herself, I think that's a big part of that. And I think the part, just for those who are saying, you know, Mikael says you're wrong if you're not, you know, if you don't, that's what she means. Kind of the misogyny towards Yennefer, I think, because of how she deals with her trauma essentially, which is really unique.
And like, I get it. Like it's easy to read this story and just be like, Yennefer's such a bitch. And like, that's not true. Like the sense of Yennefer, I think should never be predicated on like, she's a virtuous, wonderful, generous person. Cause that's not true. But like she is very human. And like, I feel like even though what she does is wrong, first of all, like she and Geralt have plenty of hurt to go back and forth in that relationship. So like, you know, it's not a one-way street. And I just think you have to just read it from that perspective. Like she, you know, the Ice Queen is in the story for a reason, you know, and it's not like Sapkowski doesn't tell these stories over so that we read them in this simplistic way, you know, where like the villain is the villain and that's it. Right. Like if, Nivellen can be, you know, the hero. Then I think the Snow Queen can also be, you know, maybe not a hero, but definitely a sympathetic antagonist in a story like this.
Mikael, Aziz also brings up a great point. They've all, like when he talked in the synopsis about longer lifespans, look at it from that perspective too. Mm-hmm. They have all experienced maybe double the amount people have experienced in one single lifetime. So I think that's a pretty interesting way to look at it too, right, Aziz?
Yeah, absolutely. And they've always, like, I tried to bring up to the aspect of power dynamics, which is that for Istrith and Yennefer, and to a lesser extent, Geralt, they've often been the more powerful one in whatever relationship they've been in. Like, they've kind of the proverbial pants, you know, that reference, whatever you want to call it. They're all not super mature, despite their age, as far as relationships. They don't have a lot of experience with healthy relationships. And that's not a slam on them. That's just an aspect of what they are, about being sorcerers and witchers. And I tried to bring up how there's not exactly a large dating pool for them. Like, sorcerer Tinder is pretty barren, right? I mean,
what about Witcher Tinder, dude?
Witcher Tinder is terrible. Yeah, it's really
bad.
It's just monsters trying to... It's just shapeshifters trying to...
Witcher Tinder is other witchers.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Who are miserable? The theme of family, like this is kind of needed before the final two stories in Sword of Destiny, because the theme of family really starts to become prevalent. We talked about this idea of like isolation and, you know, just kind of this idea of like, not having healthy relationships and having, you know, I mean, one's a sorcerer, one's a witcher. And I think that's super important for us to understand before going forward, because it makes this story even more important, because it gives us really, really good perspective on the trauma. And we're going to see more of that, obviously, throughout the story, because we get to learn more about these characters. But this is kind of like an important setting up point, I feel.
I wonder, does it make you guys sad that cats hate Geralt?
Yes, it does.
It does to me, too. And you know that finding out that Sapkowski likes cats, you know that he did this intentionally to make it sad, because you can't be a cat lover and write your main character as someone that cats hate and not intend that to be like supposed to be a little bit tragic, yeah. You know? So.
Well, Istrith even compares Geralt to a cat. So it's like there's that extra layer of like, oh.
Well, we were talking about privately something that was really interesting, like Istrith being an archaeologist excavating the idea of the past. Like, the past affects all three of these characters big time, right? Like, it formulates how they are and act in the world. It affects their relationships because of their trauma. I found that really. I feel like there's a lot of hidden analogy. Like, I know Sapkowski does it a lot, but I feel like it was extra, especially with, you know, Istrith being an archaeologist, and then obviously we have the Ice Queen story, which is just like a direct correlation to how Yennefer feels. I feel like he did a lot of that in this short story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well said. There's a lot of, like you said, you started to talk about, or we dropped a few examples of mirroring and parallels.
Yeah.
That's this story does do that really well. You mentioned a couple of good examples. McCall just mentioned the cats. That's another one. And then characters, we quoted one, the examples of them like trying to commit suicide, but via someone else, you know, suicide by mob or suicide by witcher or Cicada's suicide by, I don't know what you call that, but just suicide by stupidity.
Suicide by confidence.
Yeah. But even that is like a theme, which is the underestimating. Like, Cicada massively underestimates Geralt and believes that there's all this. He's like, oh, it's reputation. You guys just play it up, smoke in the eyes. It's all fake, you know, this and that. He's like, I'm heartless and emotionless. I can be a witcher, you know.
He basically calls Geralt fake news, which is kind of
It's true. It's like, it's kind of ironic, because he's not threatening Geralt in the slightest with, you know, his threats. But some of the things he says actually do bother Geralt. He's just not willing to show it. If Cicada knew, like calling him a mutant and all that stuff, that was actually getting to him because of all the other stuff happening around him. Like, if it was a normal day, you're not going to bother Geralt with words that easily.
It's ironic because he doesn't have emotions, yet he is feeling these things, like these stinging words from Cicadas.
Yeah, he's bitter about that. He's like, I'm not supposed to have feelings, you know? And he's just like, he's kind of leaning into it. And Yennefer's like, don't do that.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the thing from the first story, right? Where he was talking about like how he's just kind of a piece of a golem blown along by the wind, kind of like just stumbling along without emotions. I mean, the funny thing about the Witcher series is I think like it's so aggressively masculine in some ways that it really, really tricks you into not understanding how like squishy and soft and feelsy it is.
Yeah.
Like, Geralt has an actual moment in this story where he's like, there's something in my eye.
It's true. You're right. I mean, it's like you're saying, Kyle, there's like all this stuff about friendship and family and all the stuff. You're right. Like, The Witcher has this great masculine packaging with Henry Cavill and swords and stuff.
It's great that we got a female showrunner.
And I mean, it's worth pointing out that like a lot of the conversation when the show came out was like a lot of women, or you know, non-binary women people were like, hey, you know, I did not expect to find anything in the show beyond like maybe like Henry Cavill's abs, you know. But it's like, it's just like this trove of like female characters and feelings, and you know, and not that guys can't appreciate that too, because obviously guys do, but I think it's worth noting that like what the show and the book series look like, their packaging is a lot more aggressive than what is actually inside.
Anya Chalotra won, just for anyone, she won Breakout Actress of IMDb, IMDb Awards. And she was the most searched there. So Witcher, 76 million downloads on the show. I know we're doing a book podcast right now, but just kind of some framing here. Really interesting. And I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I was really trying to figure out what the Shard of Ice means. And I don't think this is maybe like the only explanation, but for me, it really kind of represents something that you can't hold on to. That is like very pain. It can hurt you, but it almost isn't there at the same time. And I think that really contrasts with the very powerful like emotions, like the something that is there and is hurting you, but you can't see it in the story. A big theme in this one is Geralt being accused constantly by Sakita and by Istrith, like calling back to other stories of being like an automaton who can't feel anything, whether it's love or disgust or whatever. Like Istrith just keeps ramping up his rhetoric to that, you know, to that extent. Cicada's even like, you know, what, like we said, like your Witcher abilities aren't even real. Like they're just smoke in the eyes. It's an illusion. Obviously, none of that's true. We know that Geralt's powers are real and we know that his emotions are also real. Even in the opening section, like it's noted, like Geralt's like, ugh. Like, yes, I'm in the garbage, but it's gross. You know, and that's a different thing from having no disgust response.
It's interesting that you bring that up, Mikael, like the emotions versus nothingness thing. Cause like, I feel like a bit of what like Istrith's insults are like projection. Mm-hmm. I feel like, it's a very toxic masculinity thing that's going on. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah. Yennefer. Mm-hmm. It's like this mating ritual almost.
That's really, yeah. Really well said. Yeah. Because that's touches on what we were saying before about how these characters are older and powerful, but they're not super mature. They don't have like a lot of experience with healthy relationships. They're used to getting what they want. So you're right. It is like Istrith is projecting. He's like, oh, she can't possibly be that interested in you because she's a sorceress and we sorceresses are the top of the top. And you're just a witcher. You're just a glorified exterminator. So yeah. So he's projecting that she could only possibly be interested in someone based on the things that he judges. Like that's, he would not be with a witcher if he was into men or whatever, because he thinks they're beneath him. So he's projecting that onto Yennefer. But clearly Yennefer is not attracted to Istrith because of his sorceressness, although that probably helps. It seems like as we move through the story, we see how much Istrith and Geralt actually have in common. And that's what Yennefer apparently was into, the things that they share. That's more likely the things that attracted her to them in the first place than whatever they're thinking.
Couple interesting comments before we move on. Yormi, Loki-san, emotions are just like a shard of ice. They are fragile, especially when not expressed healthily. And Rick Hoppy says, Alfred Hitchcock called the shard of ice the ideal murder weapon. Very interesting. And Alfred Hitchcock is a legend in storytelling. So I wonder if Sapkowski, I mean, I know there's translations, but that's really interesting, I think. And then Yormi says what we're talking about is peacocking. And that's yes. Yeah. Like showing your beautiful feathers and trying to get someone to notice you.
Something that Dandelion does. Yeah. quite well.
Just to go back to the projection for a second, like it's so clear that that's what Istrith is doing. And he's the one who's like, you're like an empty skull, whatever, you know, just a hollow sound on an empty skull. And who's the one banging on the empty skull? It's Istrith.
Yeah.
Like he's the one who's doing that. He's probably a lot like Yennefer in that like, he has a lot of unlikable qualities, but like is also capable of caring and, you know, and being a decent guy. I'm not giving him like an overwhelming benefit of the doubt because the way he treats Geralt is like absolutely disgusting. Mm. But I think there's probably a little more to him than like just that point of view.
Like he definitely has respectable qualities, right? Like he was honorable he was insulting. He was arrogant as hell, but he was honest, I think. You could give him that much. And like he was willing to be upright with his duel, you know, like he was gonna face him. He's like, no, I would never just blast you, you know, which I think Geralt gives him grudging respect for that because he could have just blasted him.
And he knows Geralt can kill him, which is partially why he's projecting. He's like, he knows Geralt is big and strong. And Geralt's like got a legend about him out there, basically being the best witcher.
Yeah.
So it's not like Istrid doesn't know that he could die in that scenario. You know what I mean? So it's like, that is interesting too. It's just a really interesting dynamic between the two of them.
He needed to accept, right? He just kept trying to find a way to be in charge still when he's just not in charge. He has to be Yennefer's partner, not her like boss in the relationship, which was what he was kind of trying to be. He was making decisions for her. He was deciding how she felt. And that's just not going to work, especially not with her. And so the only way he was going to get it to work was to accept the status quo, which it doesn't seem like he had that capacity.
This is kind of like an interesting inversion of like getting the princess trope. You know what I mean? Like two knights, one knight. He's like, I'm a good knight. I'm going to fight for her and she's going to love me because I'm a knight.
When he says, you know, we'll have to decide for her. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah. That's what it kind of felt like. But Sapkowski was obviously trying to make it way worse. You know,
they're kind of each approaching her in the wrong way. And like, again, I don't really blame them because I wouldn't want to be in a relationship with Yennefer. But like, Istrith is being way too assertive and Geralt is being the opposite. Like Geralt is just kind of like, can we please leave? And she's like, no. And he's like, okay.
He's like, when are we leaving? And, yeah.
Yeah. Like he's just not kind of asserting himself. And I think Yennefer likes both of those things. Like deep down, she both wants to be bossed around and wants to be the super boss, which is why neither of them are actually, it's not going to work because she needs an actual partner. She needs somebody that makes her both concede and control, which is, you know, some of what we see in her more successful relationships later. It's like, it's sad. I love the opening of this story. Not the Zugel part. But I was telling the guys when we were doing our notes that like the opening scene of Geralt and Yennefer really kind of led me down the wrong path of how I expected the story to be, which is that like, it's such an intimate, not just because they have sex, but like, it's a sweet thing. Like Yennefer's like taking off her makeup and like putting on her like night creams and stuff like that. And that is something that like is really personal. And especially for someone like Yennefer, who is so concerned with her appearance and is such a huge part of what she is.
That's such a great point, Mikael, because you look at like early relationships, like after the honeymoon stage, like, you know, you'll get dressed up, go out and you want to like go out for dinner and stuff like that. But like these moments of vulnerability, it's like super hard to find someone who is willing to take off the mask and be truly themselves and be vulnerable to each other, right? Yeah, Yennefer is doing that and Geralt is still accepting of her. Like obviously we find out that Geralt still loves her for her being her, right? So it's like, we find out that all of this other like extra stuff, this extracurricular stuff was really unnecessary. That people just needed to have a good talk, you know?
This episode is brought to you by Dr. Squatch. When your personal care routine needs a refresh, Dr. Squatch is here to help. They have high-performing natural products with no harmful ingredients that'll have you looking and smelling your best. Like the Bay Rum soap and deodorant. It smells delightfully spicy. And right now, they have an amazing offer for new customers. Get 20% off your first purchase of any amount or a subscription order by going to drsquatch.com/Spotify or use the code Spotify at checkout.
I was very wrong, Geralt, which irritates me, being the proud Queen of Winter, convinced of her own omnipotence. There are some things you cannot obtain even through magic. And some gifts you can't accept unless you are able to give something in return, something equally valuable. Otherwise, such a gift will slip through your fingers like a shard of ice melting in a closed fist. There will remain only regret, a sense of loss and guilt.
That's a great quote, right? Yeah. She's just talking, and she's talking about how she doesn't think she would handle it properly. She thinks that she would kind of crush his heart or something.
Or she wouldn't be able to go 50-50, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so that's what she's saying. A gift, if you can't give that gift in return, you shouldn't accept it. It seems like this is her realizing she has to break up with Istrith. And then a minute later, she's like, and you too.
I mean, it's a combination of realization and like just an assumption on her part that like, I don't think Yennefer actually believes that she's worthy of love or that people can actually love her. I think that that's a huge block and a very human block that a lot of people have. But that would kind of, you know, it's fine when you're just flitting around or whatever, or, you know, like, okay, so I'm with the Witcher now. And like, then I'll go back to Istrith. I'm like, yeah, I have feelings for them, but not like real, real feelings. And that's fine because they don't have real, real feelings for me either. Like the emotional shit hits the fan in this, story. And like, she comes to the point where she can't ignore that anymore. I really like the use of the Snow Queen because it's not abstract. Like Yennefer is actually like, I am hurting both of these people. And I was okay with that for a while. And now I'm not. now that I've realized the extent to which I'm hurting them, which is not fair because I suck. So I don't even deserve to like have their love or whatever. I can't reciprocate anything to them. So that's why she has to get out of it. And I think it's just so real and so like honest.
I think guilt is really like a really big emotion that's felt here because guilt is a super powerful thing. It's always associated with the past and past is a...
Superpower is guilt.
I'll be honest with you, chat. Like there's things in my... Like I've had some pretty big events. I still have guilt and sometimes you can like overthink about something and it affects you. And then once you overthink about these things, you think about all the other possibilities when there's only one possibility. And then you create all of these constructs and then it complicates things. And I'm not saying Yennefer is overthinking, even though she is, but like, you know what I mean? It's just like, because her trauma is so strong, it's really amplified everything in this situation. And that's why it hits the fan.
Real quick too, speaking of her trauma, I thought it was really interesting. Just like a one-liner that wasn't explored, but I thought like you could really it's a rabbit hole that could be explored is that she sleeps with the light on, that Geralt mentions that. I was like, that's interesting. I wonder like, what's that about?
It's so childlike. Yeah. It's like needing to like keep the darkness and the nightmares away. And like that is, I mean, I kind of love that it's not explored, but like that is really, I found that a very powerful line too. I'm glad you brought that up.
Then she realizes that she's becoming a monster too, in a sense, by her effect on them.
But that's her own warped view of the past of how she was as a hunchback as well. We got to remember that as well.
Yeah. And it's also self-contradicting. Mm-hmm. Like if you're good enough to make a realization that to realize the harm you caused to other people, then that sort of implies you are at least somewhat decent. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's also like part of it's when she's like telling Geralt that she is, you know, the Snow Queen. And he says that like, it's really beautiful, beautifully written, like that he's caught up with her and like he can't get free and it's cold and she's kind of like, well, I can't make you warm because you would see who I truly am, which is again ironic because physically she was exposing herself earlier in the book and in the story. But then he says like, whip your horses north so like I never have to melt and I'll just like stay here with you. And I think that's what she realizes is so destructive, you know, like he can't survive in the cold, obviously metaphorically, but he's willing to go there with her. And she like, so what she has to do is just make that impossible.
Yeah, don't follow me to your death, dude.
I'm not saying Yennefer's the heroine of this story, but like, maybe.
She has the courage to face the problem, and she's the one who solves the problem. Like, she's also part of the one to create it, but of the three of them, she's the one that like sets it all straight and makes the best of it, which is to say, stops it from becoming bloody.
Right.
I like your shirt as well, Aziz. A Witcher Popeye's shirt.
I'm Popeye the Witcher man. Spinach works a lot better than elixirs, kids.
Yeah, you don't want to die.
And without some of those side effects.
Yes. I mean, you see in this story, you definitely don't want those side effects. Spinach is much better than erectile dysfunction.
Yeah. You don't want to be drinking real iron. Mikhail, you brought up a really great point in our private conversation. We have it in the notes here. Yen versus Yenna. Those are both like, you know, like we are podcast members, you know, like we all are fairly close with each other. Like, and we, you know, we're able to connect with each other. But like if I called you a name, like we're not dating. And if I called you a name, like it would make you feel uncomfortable. Like Yen and Yenna, those are fairly personal things. And both shows that both Istrid and Geralt have their own versions of Yennefer. And I felt like that was a really cool thing that you pointed out in our private chat. Let's talk about that.
No, exactly. It's kind of like the illusion, you know, the what is she actually? Is she the person with the bare face, you know, and in her nightgown? Is she the witch dressed up with all of her magic and belladonna in her eyes and all that? Is she Yenna that Istrith knows her as? Like, she also has a nickname for, she calls him by his real name. Istrith is a nickname, apparently, whatever that's supposed to mean. And of course, Yen is so intimate with Geralt. Like, you know, isn't that's in The Last Wish, right? Like, she's like, no one's ever called me that before, call me that again. And I think she tells him not to call her that in earlier in, the first story in the book, if I'm remembering correctly. So yeah, I mean, it is that idea of like something that you can't hold on to. Like she's, you know, she's there and she's not at the same time. And like, I think a lot of these characters, their journey is ultimately like choosing to become to pick a final form, basically, you know, and like that is changes, you know, according to need, but they kind of can't stay in between, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Remember in the episode where Geralt is like, Yen, you think we would make good parents? I like that's something like you know, like he calls her Yennefer, but he uses that in a moment when he's talking about something super serious. And yeah. That's why I felt like I wanted to frame it like that when I'm like, that conversation, and even though it's in the show, you know, it's like it feels like it's really important. You know what I mean? He's trying to be like real with her, like, listen, this is my truth right now. Yen, you know what I mean? I feel like that's a deeply personal thing. Like, he's not saying Yennefer, even though he could say her full name, but like Yen, like it just felt different.
Yeah. It's like trying to cut through her exterior to remind her of their relationship and be like, look, yeah, like level with me here. You know, there's a lot of versions of Yennefer. I want to talk to the one who's trying to be a parent and level with her.
Yeah.
And also this great line one of y'all put here about the falling star. That's a great catch. The whole he just ignores it. He's like, I'm not wishing. And that's as a callback to the last wish. Yeah, yeah. That's really good.
No, no wish.
Yeah.
That was Mikal with another great catch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, before we even get like the nice scene with them, that's kind of like an indication that it's not going to go well this time. And just Geralt's bad mood. I actually wanted to ask you guys, like, do you think that Aethkin Vale is actually like any shittier than Blaviken or any of these other towns? And it's just like the contrast of Yennefer and like the possibly like impending subconscious knowledge that this relationship is coming to an end that's like putting Geralt in such a shitty mood. And like it kind of seemed to me that like he couldn't see anything beautiful in Aethkin Vale because specifically like it was the Ice Queen effect. Like he wasn't looking at Yennefer.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think there was nothing detailed about why it was worse. Like everything bad about it was just vague. It was like, yeah, there's anti-elven stuff, but that's pretty much everywhere. There was a man like assaulting a young girl, but that happens everywhere too. There's
like,
bad
Dandelion
food.
Does that.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Yeah. Like it's just, there's nothing he specifically points to about this city that is actually worse than anywhere else that I could pick out. So I agree with you. It's the Ice Queen effect. It's the shard of ice in his heart. Everything is awful when you have that going on. So yeah, I think that's perfectly a perfect fit.
It's like
there.
The equivalent of like, if you took a week vacation with your partner and you break up on the first day and you're somewhere beautiful. And then after the vacation, you're like, that really, so that, you know what I mean? That place is horrible. That place is horrible, even though it was beautiful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an interesting analogy, but that's never happened to me, by the way. I'm not describing myself. I'm just saying, I don't know.
Thank you for sharing, Kyle. Shout out to Ryan Burns in the chat, by the way, because Ryan Burns was just called Yennefer Yenny from the block. And now I need somebody to make that parody very badly.
Yeah. He also put that she sleeps with the light on in her Sorcerer Tinder profile. So he's on fire over there.
I feel like that's got to be so frustrating just to sack like Wizard Tinder or whatever. Like, oh my God, I swipe left on this guy already. Like, it's the same people.
Just a couple of other comments. Amy Blackfire is going to be talking about Yennefer on Here Be Dragons this Sunday. So go check that out. Christy Robinson says, I appreciate y'all doing these videos. We got lucky. Like, it was really nice to get in 10 episodes. We really appreciate that. You know, we think we work hard and we like to do this. So we appreciate any love that we can get. And yeah, just like a lot of really, Ryan is in chat. He's part of our Facebook group, by the way, which you can find the link to in the description video of the video. We always like to have nice chats there. We always do a thread on the specific chapter or short story that we're doing. So just an open invitation, just in case you haven't joined our group.
One thing I just want to point out very briefly is that like the suicide thing is like really intense. And I don't know if the story like gives it enough weight or if it's good that it doesn't give it that much weight. It feels complicated to me, but I think that like keeping fatalism in mind, like that's a theme that we see in The Witcher a lot. And it's kind of like this very strong battle between the forces of fatalism and inevitability and standing up against that. And like the idea that kind of like the only way through it is to get through it. You know, you can't cut out by suicide or hiding somewhere or whatever.
This is such a strong subject too. And Sapkowski likes to be funny. So it is kind of difficult. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like some people might be like, oh, it's kind of, you know, like, what's Sapkowski trying to do here? And Sapkowski is really playful in that way. It didn't bother me personally, but I'm like, you know, it might bother other people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like objecting to it. I'm just kind of like, it is such a serious thing and it's a serious story, but it's got a lot of humor in it. So it kind of, it took me a while to be like, oh, Geralt was actually expecting to die here. Like, actually. And like, he's got this smile on his face. I'm like, okay, I don't know if I want to think about this. It's really dark.
His reflexes save him, basically. Yeah, right? Yeah, he can't help it. He's like, shoom, shoom, shoom.
Well, I mean, the Zoogle is described as looking like a rotten potato. And that's how the story starts. That's what he's fighting.
I think it's like a grotesque potato. And I'm like, well, what? Yeah. That's a really odd word to use in front of potato.
I wonder if that's how it always comes up. I wonder if all the translations have it as potato. I think it does because both, as we've gone over before, we have, you know, a translated ebook version and I have audiobook, and they often have lots of small differences in translations.
Like?
And, well, in this case, this one I didn't notice, the potato, but in the case of one of the items that was on Yennefer's... Actually, no, this was not Yennefer's. This was Istrith's collection of stuff, which even that, Geralt's like, I'm not impressed. I've seen better at Yennefer's place. Even that, he's like, trying to find a way to put the guy down. But the line of... what is the line? He's like, he sees what looks like homunculus, but is actually could be a smoked newborn baby.
And the audiobook part, right?
Yeah. And the audio in the audiobook is a smoked newborn baby. In the tech, in the book version it's that we have here, it says preserved fetus. So it's
which is
one has more humor added to it for sure.
Yeah.
Those two things are quite different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not that I'm like pro preserved fetus, but like you could imagine that in a scientific context, like smoked newborn. I mean, I wonder
if that's part also of Geralt's just like trashing Istrith. He's like, he's probably got a baby in there. Like, he would do that. He would.
Yennefer has a huge mountain troll penis.
I think that was the craziest thing I've heard on the, or the weirdest thing I've heard on the podcast yet. I don't know if I'm pro fetus or not. smoked preserved fetus. Anyways.
One of y'all wrote this note about the parallel at the start, how like Geralt is digging in a ditch or digging in the dump and Istrith is, you know, excavating. That's a really good catch because it's like, yeah, it's that whole social structure thing. Like Geralt is much lower on the social ladder. So his digging in the dirt is of a lower type where Istrith is, oh, I'm an archaeologist. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Fossils.
And even like the way they're treated, Geralt is actually saving lives. You know, like he has that really kind of disturbing conversation with the mayor where he's like, oh, 8 people, no one important, like just some children and like that drunk guy. And it's like, holy sh. And meanwhile, like, you know, I'm super pro archaeology and history and all that. But like the mayor is kind of like, well, we just let Istrith do his, like, he considers it pretty similar. Like he's just digging in the dirt, like whatever, this garbage. But he gives us, you know, he protects us, or like he, you know, we get other benefits from him being here. So like you, person saving lives, like we're not going to treat you with respect because you went into the garbage, but the other person we will, for, you know, for more selfish and, I mean, maybe still important, but maybe less important than actually saving lives.
Geralt's kind of a frontline worker, as to use a modern parlance, whereas Istrith is, you know, he's an academic, which that's important too. But, you know, I know who I'd give the vaccine to first.
Vaccinate Geralt of Rivia.
You know, this part in the Zoogle part, I actually applies to what we're talking about. I actually found this passage particularly interesting because it applies to this on the Witcher fandom wiki. It says, the Zoogle is a monster that has grown accustomed to human settlement. The beast feeds on waste and filth produced by the city, so it need not hunt to fight or survive. To fight to survive. It simply grows and gradually becomes a danger to people. And then I put this in bold. This shows how detrimental continued degradation of natural environment can be in the long run. Ooh. Therefore, I implore the reader, respect nature. Pretty interesting. In the Witcher bestiary.
That's pretty good. Kind of a,
you know, I mean, we got, you know, we see Geralt, he saves, I mean, this Zugul has killed 8 people, right? Yeah. Like, that's a pretty big deal, and they need to stop it. And the Zugul feeds on the filth of humanity, you know, it grows by that. So there's some pretty interesting analogies here, I feel like, at the start of the story, kind of this representation of human nature and the waste we produce and kind of... Or, you know, what we do. I don't know. Do you guys feel that too?
That's a good take. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like you can't just ignore all this building up waste, all this foulness. If you don't deal with it, it's going to come back and kill some people. Or, you know, metaphorically, you would say it was going to come back and bite you in the ass. But which I guess that's that even that joke is made by Cicada saying, you know, if you sting them in the ass, they'll respond quick enough, you know.
So. It's like if you were to leave nuclear waste in the middle of a town, obviously people would get sick.
Yeah, like you could leave it there for a little while and it wouldn't do much harm, but eventually it's going to do serious harm. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
And they didn't choose, I mean, not that they didn't choose to deal with it, but 8 people, you know, maybe they should have chose 2 people. You know what I mean? I don't know.
And that's even pointed out, like Geralt says, look, you're going to want to check back in a month and all you'll need is dogs because the young Zugals are, you don't have to worry about those.
And Mikhail, you brought up an interesting point, not to spoil the next story, but Eternal Flame takes a bigger setting, you know what I mean, than this. So it's like the big city versus small city kind of dynamic. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the actual biggest city on the continent is featured in the next story. So that's going to, some of this is kind of building up to that, which is nice. We get to see Sapkowski's world building, the different ways he puts his cities together and the way he makes them work. That's going to be fun. Yeah. There's a lot of Celtic stuff today. Obviously, the Wild Hunt isn't just a Celtic thing, but it's a recognized perhaps more so than other versions of the Wild Hunt because there's a Germanic version, there's an American Indian version. It's a huge collection. And even though there's no specific fairy tale influence today, the man who compiled just about everything we know about the Wild Hunt legends from a variety of cultures around the world is none other than Grimm himself, as in Grimm's fairy tales. So we still do get a little bit of fairy tale aspect, even though it's a little indirect. So that's cool. The reason that we say Istrith instead of Istrid is because of Welsh influence, which is, you know, Celtic Welsh. It's those are kind of overlap. That is how they say DD in Welsh. They say it's pronounced TH. So when the audiobook says Istrith and Aeth Ginvale, you may hear it pronounced with the D instead. Like on TV, they just say Istrid, and that's fine. You know, I won't tell someone how to say it. I'll recognize it either way, and I think we all can recognize the word no matter how it's pronounced.
My sister was rereading the Wheel of Time books, and one of the like baddies or beasties in that book are called Murdral.
Yeah.
But I was pronouncing it Mirthral because it is.
Oh, they do
D.
have two D's.
And she was like, why are you doing that? And I was like, because it's a double D and it's Welsh. And she's like,
wow. I've always thought of them as Mirdral, but you're right. It might be Mirthral. Might be. That's cooler.
Mithral. Yeah. Mithral is like a type of metal that's often used in armor.
That's pretty cool. I like that. So the Celtic influence continues with the slip up, the alderman calling her. He's like, what's her name? Guinevere? It's like, Guinevere? Yeah, that's a pretty strong parallel to Yennefer. I mean, the name is that those are similar names. They're like the same origin, the name Yennefer, Jennifer, Guinevere, Guinefar. Those are all like the same root name.
Shout out to our friend Lady Gwyn.
Yeah, Lady Gwyn. And, you know, the love, the story of Guinevere in Arthurian legends is very much tied to a love triangle, right? That's a big part. Lancelot, Arthur, and Guinevere. So there's a love triangle here. Guinevere is almost every version of her legend, and there's lots of them. So there's exceptions, but almost all of them have her as childless, with black hair, and often she's portrayed as a sorceress. Certainly not as powerful as Yennefer, but still a sorceress. And so there's a lot of parallels there. And the Wild Hunt is often associated with Arthurian legends specifically, not just Celtic myths overall. So there's a lot of dot connecting here. All the influences all seem to be tied to each other. So it's a very consistent theme of influence here with this Celtic Welsh stuff, which is pretty much all over the Elven influences anyway in the Witcher world.
The Wild Hunt kind of reminds me a little bit of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, when I was reading about it.
The Four Horsemen of the Continent. The Four Horsemen of the Continent.
When I was reading about it, that's specifically mentioned as a alternate, like, similar legend. So you're totally right. Like, that's a bullseye right there.
And Snow Queen.
Let it go.
Let it go. Let it go.
And there's, okay, so we caught one. Well, at least one non-Celtic influence thing. One of the two guys accosting Geralt that runs away is named Radagast, which, like, if you're a Lord of the Rings person, you might recognize that as maybe a reference to Radagast.
Yeah. Is that the one who also says, like, by Baal Zebub or something like that?
The Hermit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That caught my attention, too. Yeah. By Beelzebub. That's an odd thing
Baal
to say.
Because Baal Zebub is what it is in Hebrew. So it's like, yeah.
Bye, Beelzebub.
Bye, the flies.
Talking about the Wild Hunt specifically is a little tricky for us. We don't want to get into the details because it is part of the story later, which is something of a spoiler, but it's out there. We can't not mention it because, frankly, I mean, that's the name of the third game, right? And that's, this game has sold, what, Kyle? Like 30-some million copies?
34 million copies.
So you can't exactly conceal that a game that sold 34 million copies is called The Witcher 3 The Wild Hunt.
We will say, though, Arthurian legend becomes more important as the books grow.
Considerably. Mm-hmm.
Considerably. But I will tease that they are tied to a specific prophecy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really cool.
Okay, so kestrels, real quick. We don't have a lot to say about them, but there's some symbolism there. They're basically small falcons. The females are larger than the males, that has some symbolic resonance here, them being more powerful, the ones that are kind of in charge. And they don't make nests. They a little more transitive, and they take what's there. They like find a hollow or a cave and just live there for a while, and they move on. So that also has some symbolic resonance with the way Yennefer is, you know, kind of moving around. She doesn't really stay in one place for super long. She's bigger in a sense, you know, in a metaphorical sense, than these guys. Some more powerful. So that's pretty cool.
Not staying in one place is pretty big deal.
So shout out to Ludmilla for some assistance on helping with the kestrel research there. Let's talk a little bit of herblore. There's not a lot this time. Some of them are repeated, like Mandrake, Belladonna, Lilac, and Gooseberries. We've talked about all those before. Unspecifically, there's the mention of the elixirs causing harm to Geralt. And it's one of the themes is that Yennefer is very, she dotes on him in terms of his physical health. The elixirs can keep Geralt from getting it up, but Yennefer has Viagra Kadabra. Oh, yeah. She has some little spell that works, and he says it's quite extraordinary.
Viagra Kadabra!
That's what she went to school for.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't clip that, everyone.
So as far as ones we hadn't talked about, things that were lying around in her lab or in Istrith's, there was cannabis, which we're not going to get into talking about cannabis. That's a humongous topic. I mean,
does that have any mystical properties? Or?
It's like there is just, it is probably the most written about psychoactive drug or just the most written about substance of all time, quite possibly. So it's rather large topic. What I find interesting is it might be a little bit of Sapkowski's sense of humor because, first of all, psychoactive states, historically speaking, from legend, are often associated with people trying to do real world magic. And of course, marijuana, cannabis, whatever you're preferred term for it, is obviously associated with psychoactive states. But cannabis is also associated heavily with introspection. And that's something that, I mean, let's be honest, Istrith could probably do good with a joint or two.
Yes! Geralt could use it for his medicinal properties for all his bumps and bruises.
Yeah. I agree. So pretty much like almost everyone in the story could use some chill. Also, there's antimony, which isn't an herb, but it's mentioned and it's kind of important. It's got some good symbolism as well. It's used as a cosmetic a lot. It's got a metallic aspect to it. So it's good, especially for like eyeshadow. But here's where the deep symbolism comes. It's best when paired with other metals. It's like a symbiotic metal almost. It works. It's its best when it's combined with something else. In particular, it can be used to, if you burn it with gold or silver, it destroys all the other impurities. So it basically makes antimony and gold mixed together can make pure gold. It gets rid of all the stuff. And it's called, because of that, it's called the wolf of metals because it eats everything else. So that's neat.
That's cool.
Yeah, the idea of binding is cool too. You know what I mean? Chemically becoming attached to someone.
Which makes sense as a cosmetic. It has to be able to attach. But of course, the deeper meaning is people working better together than they do separately. Yeah. So that's great. And with the wolf thing thrown in.
Yeah, the idea of the periodic table here on the podcast is a surprise. We're teaching you things.
I think you could even draw like a parallel. I mean, this is looking way too deep into it. And I'm sure this is not what Sapkowski had in mind. But when, you know, Yennefer says like, warmth would destroy what we have because you would see me for what I really am. Like that's kind of in terms of like purifying the perception.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And also metal is more malleable when it's warm as opposed to being cold.
Oh, very true. Yeah. That's also very true. Good call. So I thought that was neat. As usual, sometimes these might just be coincidences, parts of it, but sometimes when they line up this well, it's like, cool, how could that be a coincidence?
And this is what we're here for. Yeah. Like, we're here to, like, basically exacerbate it. Come on.
Yeah, so it's been worth it. Like, the first few episodes, we're like, okay, I'm going to dig into this herb lore. But if it hadn't gotten us anywhere, we would have stopped doing it. But it's just like, okay, now it's one of the things I look forward to the most. I'm like, okay, now I'm going to research the herbs or the metals or whatever.
And Sapkowski's super clever, too. Like, when we did our Novellan episode, we did a Grade of Truth. Like, the mushrooms, especially, like, you know, the way they were in formation. You know, what was it called? The Devils?
Devil's Rings, yeah.
Yeah, so stuff like that. Like, this is kind of this kind of deal, I think, specifically. In this story, I think that those are kind of a great comparison. It's pretty funny, specifically according to the Zugel. I talked a little bit about it earlier, but according to Geralt, before they enter the sewers, he says the Zugels are hermaphrodites. But he says, Zugels do not need a Miss Zugel to make little Zugels. And I don't know. I just found that really funny. I found it like really weird and funny.
Oh, that is kind of funny. Yeah, it is like it doesn't need anyone else.
Yeah, and then they have a whole conversation about snails and mice.
Oh, yeah. How they
mice that hatch from dust.
I love those medieval superstitions about, yes, mites just come from
this. I think that's actually something from the Talmud, like something about mice.
Interesting.
Yeah, I could be wrong, so don't take that as for sure, but I feel like I've heard that somewhere.
Smoke in the eyes, Witcher. Nothing but smoke in the eyes. You confound people like a beekeeper smokes out bees with your stone-like faces, your bravado, and your reputation likely contrived by yourselves. The bees stupidly flee the smoke rather than stinging you in the arse, which would swell up just like any others. They say that you don't feel like humans do. Nonsense. If any one of you got a good jab, you'd feel it.
Finished?
Yes, said Cicada as he gave the Witcher his sword. Do you know what intrigues me, Witcher?
Yes. Bees.
That's so good. It's like he just does not give a crap about this dude. I have nothing but contempt for you.
If it was Henry Cable doing the yes bees, it would be hilarious too. Yeah. Right?
I'm sure that helped. Because
that's super funny.
It's funny because he sort of esteems him as a fighter because he does say that he knows the price on his head and he would have thought it was a low price.
That's true. And he notices, like at the beginning, he notices that he's like, I'm keeping my eye on his hands. And he notices that Cicada's keeping his eye on Geralt's hands. But then when Cicada doesn't keep his eye on Geralt's hands, he gets popped in the mouth. And then that's the end of it.
That was very satisfying.
Yeah, exactly. It's like someone needs to get punched. And it was satisfying for Geralt, too, because he writes like he could feel his anger dissipating.
And you know what's funny about the Cicada? Obviously an insect, but they hibernate, but they can, like, whenever they come out, like, they come out in bunches and they're super annoying, and Cicada is super annoying, so I don't know know if there's like some sort of kind of correlation between Cicada being an idiot and being annoying and the insects, and they're kind of...
Well, they're really loud. Yeah, they're really loud, and they're so loud that they could even... The male cicadas can actually harm human hearing if you hear it close enough.
Or I'm just imagining Sapkowski writing this story one summer when the cicadas are out. He's like, I need an annoying name. Ah, shut up. I need an annoying... Ugh. Can't even...
He's like, aha. That's great. I love how they both realize, Geralt and Istrith both realize that the pet names they use for Yennefer deeply affect the other person hearing it. Like when Geralt hears that Istrith says Yenna, and when Istrith hears that Geralt says Yen, they're just like, what? They're so angry, and so they use it as a weapon. He's like, Yenna. And Geralt's like, Yen, when she told me, Yen told me that. And they're like hitting each other with these pet names, and it totally works because they're both getting reactions from the other, and that just encourages them to keep doing it.
Yeah. Also, that scene is just so well orchestrated toward the end. The way Geralt is so convinced that he's gonna finish him off. He's like got the upper hand. And then Istrith just comes out with like, well, I slept there this morning. And like just the way it crashes. And then they're both just like sitting there like, are we done? Yeah, we're done. Go away. Like
It reminds me of, I won't say when it's coming, but this is a very vague spoiler. There's a moment much later in the series where a certain person draws this sword out that they paid a lot of money for, and the first time the sword actually gets used, it just breaks immediately. And it's like, yeah, that's this. He's like, oh, I've got my weapon ready. I'm gonna, oh. He's got the same weapon, so it just breaks.
What about this? He had lived at Yennefer's house in Vangerberg for 6 months, and she possessed an even more interesting collection, including a phallus of unprecedented proportions, apparently from a mountain troll, so a giant troll dick. She also had a magnificent stuffed unicorn, fans of the game, you'll know this one, a post upon whose back she liked to make love. Geralt was of the opinion the only place even less suited for lovemaking would be the back of a live unicorn.
That reminds me of, do you guys remember Clerks?
Yes.
Where they kept talking about the back of a Volkswagen the most. So he's like, the only place to make love that's less comfortable is the live unicorn. Yeah. So that would be chasing.
And Geralt's just like, well, we have this perfectly good bed.
Like, yeah.
He's like, why the unicorn? Yeah. And there's a whole scene in The Witcher 3, The Wild Hunt. They're on Skellige. And anyways, they go in there and then there's a scene with them naked on the... Like, you get a chance to romance Yen or Triss in the game. And I always choose Yen because of the damn stuffed unicorn moment. It's the best. So for those of you who are looking for sexy time in The Witcher, there you go.
Keep an eye out for that unicorn.
and it's funny, someone put... So it's funny, Geralt and Istrid's dick measuring conversation. And
yes. Well, we also have a pirouette count.
Moving on.
There is one pirouette in the story.
One. We had one last week, I think, or last time, but we hadn't had one in a while. We were a little pirouette dry for a while.
Yeah.
And Amy says, so much eggplant in this short story. Spam the eggplant emojis in chat, everyone. Horny jail for all of you. Okay. I think that's going to do it for the podcast today. This is a really fun one. You know, this has been a really fun endeavor for us. It's been over a year since we got The Witcher season one. And that's kind of how we all started kind of getting talking about this. You know, I talked to Aziz and I kept on badgering him about finishing the books because he had been flying everywhere. And he's like, Kyle, I'm reading the books, man. I'm really into this. And I'm like, dude, we got to talk about this show. I'm telling you.
Hell yeah.
I'm like, I didn't say the next Game of Thrones, but he knew what I meant about it. And then Aziz recruited me, Kyle. And now we're here, the trio with 10 YouTube episodes, which is great. I feel like a little applause. We made it through a 10 episode. We survived.
We can pat ourselves on the back a little bit here.
And we got, of course, on Anchor, we have all of our downloadable episodes that are up there in a nicely, neatly organized playlist. Thank you for everyone that supported us. We really appreciate that.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's awesome to have a community building around the show and our show as well.
If you do want to support us, it's pretty cool. On Anchor, you can do the $1 option, the $5 option, or $10 option. There's a support button. You don't have to do that. Like I said, your support, you coming to watch the podcast, listening, leaving us a review. If you enjoyed the podcast on any of the listening platforms that you use, is obviously super helpful. Tell us how awesome we are. Mm-hmm. Give us 5 stars. Mm-hmm. Say, yeah, you guys are cool. We love the Witcher podcast. Bye, everyone. Woo!